The KYMN Climate Show is a monthly feature here on 95.1 The One and AM 1080, discussing changes in climate and the science behind it. And now, your hosts, Alan Anderson and Bruce Moreland.
Welcome to the KYMN Climate Show with Bruce Moreland and Alan Anderson, where we discuss climate issues in the news, and then we dig into the stories behind those stories. Today, we're going to talk about how one service organization, Rotary and Rotary International, is handling the issue of climate change. But first, some stories in the news. So, Bruce, what have you found in recent weeks?
Well, Alan, I found a really interesting story, the kind of story that I really get into because I like to follow science back to the roots. And it turns out that scientists have solved what to them was a major climate mystery, which is confirming that the Earth is hotter than it's been in at least 120 centuries. That's what's called the Holocene period. And it's the interglacial since the glaciers started retreating back in the day during the glacial cycles. So it's kind of interesting. What I wanted to let people hear about is the kinds of headlines that you read at different levels of the story. So in the first level, it's just that it is warmer than it's been in at least 120 centuries. That's the space.com headline. And they were reporting what science has done. But in Rutgers, which is apparently the Rutgers Institute on Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences, they had the headline, Important Climate Change Mystery Solved by Scientists. Okay, so a clickbait type headline, a couple of them there. But the third one is, my heavens, I can't quite read it.
From Nature Magazine.
From Nature Magazine, thank you. You couldn't understand it. I won't even try and replicate it because I don't have the printout corrected. But
and it got deeply into the weeds of the
science. It got into the weeds. It was using science terms and all kinds of stuff. And it was a loss leader for people who were trying to find the science. So it was pretty cool. What they discovered was that previously published sea surface temperature and information that used information from foraminifera, which is the single-celled organisms, that allows them to reconstruct temperatures. You know, we've talked before about how you reconstruct temperature data, and that's how you do that. And it turns out that you use oxygen isotopes and do all that kind of stuff. And what they found was that it has been warming over the past 12,000 years, just like they thought it would. But they also discovered that their model, interestingly, had to account for the ice cubes. And what do I mean by ice cubes? Well, you might remember that at one point there was a mile of ice over most of Minnesota and Iowa and places like that, and all of Europe was covered with ice. And basically, we took a while to melt that down. You know, things that they just didn't disappear overnight. So what they had was a really nice graph that showed that as the receding ice stopped acting like ice cubes in your summer drink, remember you put your ice cubes in that summer drink and they start to disappear on you. As that starts to recede and doesn't act as much as a refrigerant, if you will, the atmosphere warms up. And as it's doing, we also see CO2 going up. And it's really interesting because modern agriculture begins about the beginning of the Holocene, right, 12,000 years ago. And we kind of switch the way we're dealing with the earth and how we're using soil. And you can see a little trend there, but boy, that model completely gets broken when we go into the Industrial Revolution.
When we start burning coal.
We start burning coal. And you can see that really clearly in the data. It's just like, oh, it's so obvious you want to facepalm yourself that you didn't see it before. But, of course, you're not going to see it before because it takes that dramatic jump to kind of signal what's going on. So, anyway, this is an example of how science works because they have a model and it's just not quite right yet. They know that there's something maybe got to be looked at that they aren't looking at. And when they finally adjusted for everything, now they're much happier that they're able to say that the planet is warming. And, of course, this is how science is working. Politics made up its mind 40 years ago, 50 years ago. And it's very hard for them to change their mind. And why is that? Because they don't get paid for changing their mind. They get paid for being stalwarts, hardcore. Scientists make a living off of changing each other's mind. They love to find something wrong with somebody else's model and point it out, as we've talked about before. That's how you make your name. That's how you get the Nobel Prize, is when you spot something that nobody else spotted and you bring it to the front. And so this is a minor thing. It's a fun thing. And I kind of enjoyed reading about that one.
Well, and a super Cliff Notes would be for all those people who remember hearing about the medieval warm period when the Vikings settled in Greenland and so forth. Yes, folks, it is warmer now than it was then. And never warmer in the last 12,000 years than it is today.
Absolutely. And by the way, you have to be careful using the term Viking, because apparently in Norway they prefer that you call them the ancient Norwegians. They don't like the term Viking. So anyway.
So I've got a story to share. And this is just in the news earlier this month. Billion-dollar disasters shatter U.S. records in 2020. There were 22 events in 2020 that caused at least $1 billion worth of damage, and mostly related to climate change. And these were composed of hurricanes, tornadoes, wildfires, and the ratio, which is a giant downward straight line wind that hit Iowa this summer and damaged over 10 million acres of cropland. And to try to envision that, all of the forest fires that burned in the West this year set a new all-time record for damage, 10 million acres up in smoke. And so in 2020, all the disasters caused more than $95 billion worth of damage and killed hundreds of people. And since 1980, natural disasters have cost $2.2 trillion, with the highest levels coming just in the last 10 years. And so as the representatives of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration folks would say, stopping climate change must be our highest priority if we don't want this to get ever worse. And they do acknowledge that our increasing population and our increasing wealth, which causes us to build expensive houses right on the coast in the path of hurricanes, or build our new dream homes ever deeper into the forest of the California foothills, is part of the problem, because we go out of our way to build stuff where there's going to be disasters.
So I have a question for you, Alan. If I was a banker and I was about to loan someone $1 million so they could build $1.5 million house, because I'm assuming they're going to put down $500,000 of their own money, Why would I let them do that where I know that there's a pretty good chance that my investment in that mortgage is at risk? How do I get around that?
There's two interesting factors there. One is the insurance industry, if the house is built, it'll be insured, so you as the bank might be covered.
Right.
But secondly, lots of banks really don't care, because they're going to just package up the loan that they loan to you and sell it to somebody else.
And who do they usually like to sell it to? Their first banker of selling to is?
Well, they sell it to you and me.
You mean FEMA and Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae?
That's right.
So we get to take all that risk, and they just make their money and go on to the next house, as it were.
Do you think there's anything wrong with that plan, folks?
Nope.
A little more about this story. So 2020 was the fifth hottest year ever in the continental U.S., but across the world, the global averages, 2020 tied for the hottest year ever recorded. Our world is just getting steadily hotter, and we should be trying to do something to prevent it from continuing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've got a second and related story, and this was just This came out January 31, which was yesterday. Yesterday or the day before? Climate change ravaged the West with heat and drought last year, and many fear that 2021 will be even worse. And here it's along the same lines as the last article, but now we're focusing more on the West and the Southwest. And not only have they had unprecedented fires, but those fires have been being caused by withering droughts and heat waves, which just dry out the forest and the foothills and make them just tinderboxes waiting for a match. And so in the past, we've read a lot about California having terrible fires. And in fact, yet again, they had their worst fire season ever. But now Colorado had the worst fire season in the state's history. Utah, the driest year on record. Arizona, high temperatures killing more people from heat than ever before. And climatologists tell us that it's going to just slowly, steadily get warmer and in the Southwest, drier if we stay on the road we're on. And one would have to say, maybe we should get off of this road.
That's a possibility. You know, it's interesting when I do my coffee sessions with my friends that are down in Arizona right now, and they're pretty comfortable down there as we're kind of chilled up here. But I'm guessing that we're going to see something like a reverse snowbird where people who normally would live in the South will have to come north in the summer because they can't afford to stay there anymore. They can't tolerate it.
Yep.
It's going to be like that.
Yeah, it'll be instead of the snowbirds, it'll be the heatbirds.
The heatbirds, yeah, there you go.
Just a little bit more from this same article, and it's talking about the fact that out in the Colorado River Basin, which covers a number of states, the snowpack is so poor and snow-covered areas in the West so low that they're expecting that they're going to have a water crisis this next year. In this area, Lake Powell, the nation's second largest reservoir, is only at half its capacity, and typically they would be looking for the snowpack to rejuvenate it. But if the snowpack doesn't deliver, then they're in big trouble, and they're actually talking about implementing an emergency measure that they have not had to implement in the past, which causes water to be cut off to an ascending level of priorities. And so there's great angst right now that they're going to have water problems. And this last year, over 1,443 counties in the U.S. are actually, this is as of January 21, 1,443 counties are in either extreme or extraordinary drought in the West. And they should not actually be in drought at this time of the year. And even the USDA Farm Service says about Utah, the ponds are dry, the streams are dry, springs that normally supply livestock are dry, and the rivers are historically low. And if things don't change, we're going to have to see big sell-offs of livestock and probably land in the coming season. So sobering times. But the thing we have to keep coming back to is it is going to get even worse unless we do something. We need, as we have talked about in the past, we need federal legislation that puts a price on carbon so that we move away from the path that we're on.
And in the meantime, we also need to start being realistic about where we're letting things happen. You know, I lived out west for a while, and it was interesting to hear the backstory on the water problems that they have. And there's a reason why the Westerners say that whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting. They've had water wars out there, just like you hear about in the Middle East sometimes. They've had water wars out there forever. And part of the reason is they had a wet decade or two, and everybody got fat on it and thought, oh, this is going to be great. And then they allocated water based on those fat decades, and then it went dry. And so they divided up water that they're not getting anymore.
Right.
And as you said, you know, it's going to boil down to do the people get water or do the farmers get water? Well, the farmers are going to be screaming, we're the ones that provide jobs and income and
food.
I mean, they do a lot of important stuff. And so I can, you know, you've all heard of the California toilet, right? You have to flush it twice because it only uses a gallon of water on the flush. And that's the problem. You know, we're going to try and if we try and regulate our way out of it, we're going to run into those issues where we make bad choices based on bad data or bad philosophies. And your carbon fee and dividend is a great fix for that. So
Ruth, what's your fourth story?
Oh, you know, I'm in the military or a retired military, so I'm always paying attention to what they're up to. And then I've told you a couple times that I went down to Omaha once to be a panelist on a movie called The Burden, which is about how the military is having to deal with the change in fuel and trying to move away from fossil fuels and all of that. But the other side of it is they're having to deal with and plan for climate change in the short and mid-term. So while a lot of the stuff we're talking about doesn't happen until the end of the century, a lot of the stuff that the military is worried about is already happening. They're watching turmoil in the Middle East. There's evidence that the Arab Spring, which collapsed fairly quickly, was initiated in part by crop failures caused by climate change. We know that Syria's got a huge agricultural problem, where their agricultural system is collapsing again because there's not enough water to go around. So the military is aware, and if you read, as I do, have been paying attention because I was in the military, so I've had a lot of interest in this, we're always about trying to plan for things that other people don't think about. So for me, the interesting story was that battleships used to be the cream of the fleet. Everybody wanted to have a big battleship. It was like you could beat your chest and sail around the world. You remember the when Teddy Roosevelt used the fleet to kind of make a statement? Well, by the time World War II came around, there were a lot of people who realized that a battleship was just a big floating target and that you could bring in a couple, you know, squadrons of airplanes and do a pretty good number on a battleship. So as the technology was evolving, the military kept being held back from doing what it knew it needed to do because people had this emotional attachment to the battleship. And we saw in Vietnam where the military kind of knew what they needed to do, but the politicians were trying to run the war from D.C. McNamara, remember the best and the brightest and all of that. And then we had the same thing in the last, you know, couple of administrations, at least the last administration, where they suppressed military planning that was trying to address global warming and climate change. So they've kind of had a downplay at some risk to their planning factors, the impact of things like mass migrations. And going back to Syria and Egypt, there's a lot of people moving, not just because of turmoil in their home state, but because the climate has exacerbated. It's what they call in the military a force multiplier. It's made the turmoil at the home state much worse because while the political turmoil is coming out, it's partly driven by the fact that people are hungry. They're having trouble with their agriculture. They're having trouble with their sustainability. I mean, you've got parts of the world, as we've talked about many times, you've got parts of the world where you can't be outside during the day because the temperature, even in the shade, is too high for the human body to keep itself cool. And, you know, when you're confronted with that, you know, when you're on the Titanic and the water is lapping around your ankles in the hallway, you're going to move unless somebody has locked you downstairs like they did to the third class in the Titanic. And so the military, recognizing that, has realized that it's got a changing role. On top of that, a lot of the bases that they've built are not sustainable because of water rise. We've got issues in both coasts where like Norfolk, where you can't use the base the way you used to because some days you can't get around it. And it's just going to get worse. The military knows that. They're planning for it. I one of the things they're discovering is they're spending a lot of their money on what? Rescue missions, where they're bringing in, you know, they've got these ships for doing medical, and they're having to support these disasters, humanitarian support, and we call the military in to help with that, mostly because they have the infrastructure for it. So, I mean, when you've got the infrastructure to fight a war, when you're not fighting a war, you can send those hospital ships to locations and you can help with things. So they're facing this changing world, and now under the new administration, they're going to have a little bit better opportunity to do that, because the new SecDef, Austin, has already indicated that he's going to allow climate change to be part of their thinking, and that's a good thing. They're already looking for alternatives too for their power supplies, and that goes back to the burden. They are working very hard on being self-sufficient on both water locally, in other words, desalinization or whatever, but also on energy. So they embrace solar power and nuclear power as a way to get energy out in the field where they need it. So the military is going to lead the way once they're unfettered by political posturings, as it were. So, if I can just mention, you are listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1, broadcasting out of Northfield, Minnesota. This is The Climate Show with your hosts, Bruce Moreland and Alan Anderson. And today we're talking about Rotary International and how individual Rotary clubs are working on climate change.
And let me tell you a little bit about Rotary. And wait, Rotary? I thought this was The Climate Show. Yes, again, we're going to talk a little bit about Rotary because Rotary is beginning to take serious action on climate change. But before we get there, let me tell you just a little bit of background about Rotary, because that background informs what Rotary might be able to do on climate. Rotary was formed in 1910 near Chicago, initially as a businessmen's networking club that also did good work in their communities. Today, Rotary has 1.2 million members in 35,000 clubs across 200 countries. And its motto is service above self. And Rotary has done some incredible projects across the world, especially helping the less fortunate. And one of the signature projects has been to work at eradicating polio. Since the start in 1985, 2.5 billion children have been inoculated against polio. And when we started the program, over 125 countries still had polio in their country, paralyzing some 350,000 children every year. Today, because of the work of Rotary and the Gates Foundation working together as a team, there's polio in only 2 countries of the world, and we're working hard to eradicate it from those last 2.
Let me just throw in something for our younger listeners. I grew up when polio was still endemic, and they would close the pool sometimes in the summer, the swimming pool, because that was part of where polio was spread, was through public swimming pools. And I have pictures in my mind of giant rooms filled with people in iron lungs trying to survive because of what polio can do to you. And that when that vaccine showed up, it must have been, I was too young to remember the particular transition, but I do remember that it was just the parents and everybody were just amazed. They were blown away and they couldn't wait to get that vaccine into their children's arms, because polio was a scare. It was a big thing to be afraid of. And we forget sometimes, you know, we've got smallpox, we've got polio, we got a lot of diseases that we have tackled fairly nicely with vaccines. It's really important to remember that. But when it was endemic around the world and Rotary stepped in, you said that was in 85?
Yep.
That was a big change. And why was that a big change? Because it really did represent them stepping way back and looking at a worldwide problem and coming out of any kind of a local only type frame of mind. So it was a big deal, I think.
Yep. And now, this wonderful Rotary organization, and I might mention both Bruce and I are Rotarians, has announced its intention to begin working on climate change. And by unanimous vote of the Rotary trustees and the board of directors, they've adopted a new focus area called Protecting Our Environment. And within Protecting Our Environment, some of the things that are specifically addressed, addressing the causes of climate change and climate change disruption, and supporting solutions to reduce the emissions of greenhouse gases. And another, strengthening the resilience of ecosystems and communities affected by climate change and climate disruption. And we are hopeful that through the work of Rotary, they can have eventually as great an impact as they have had on polio by smart, good people working together to tackle this problem the world over. And then coming back to our local Rotary Club, looking at these challenges, our local Rotary Club started a Rotary Climate Action Team within our club. And we have now some 18 members within our club on that team. And we have also helped Rotary Climate Action Teams start in many, many other clubs and actually a couple of other countries now through the Rotarian magazine. And there's an organization within Rotary called the Environmental Sustainability Rotary Action Group, which is a international Rotary committee. And they're the ones that really helped bring protecting our environment with its climate elements to Rotary's international attention. So it's all very exciting.
It is indeed. And one thing I should throw in a real footnote is that you can join the Environmental Sustainability Rotarian Action Group without being a Rotarian.
Right.
You can actually sign up and offer to support them.
And if you'd have any interest in learning more about that, it's ESRAG.org. And you can just go to their website, learn about them, join if you'd like.
Yep. Now, one of the things that is interesting from my perspective as an activist is that Rotary discovered that some these really partisan issues like climate change require more work at building consensus. You have to actually pay attention to the language you use and how you engage everybody in the club, because not everybody is going to be on board right away. And so I have two organizations that I want to mention. One of them is Citizens Climate Lobby. And they have been working on bipartisan solutions from the get-go, and they started in 2007. And it's a bipartisan-friendly framing, which means that we don't use this alarmist language when we don't have to. We don't use the soundbite bumper sticker level of discussion. We keep it bipartisan-friendly. We work on a bipartisan solution, which is the carbon fee and dividend that we've talked about, which is a market-based solution, which appeals to both to conservatives, but it has a built-in environmental justice component in the way that the money is used without creating that feeling of it being a handout. It's just a dividend. It's what you have a right to because you're a citizen. Very, very bipartisan in that sense. And Citizens Climate Lobby pays real attention to keeping it bipartisan. We have lots of subgroups within Citizens Climate Lobby, like the Conservative Caucus, which I used to chair, and the Braver Angels Action Team, which I co-chair right now, which are both dedicated to keeping our solution in the bipartisan arena and keeping both conservatives and liberals on board, or progressives. Now, in addition to that, you might have heard me drop a hint about Braver Angels. The Braver Angels Action Team actually grew out of the organization Braver Angels, which I was a part of as well. And they are also an addition to the field of people that are working on bipartisan solutions, recognizing that you can't win at 51%. If you only have a 51% buy-in on your solution, then when that 1% switches on you and all of a sudden you're in the 49%, it's just like what we saw in the last couple of weeks. the last administration came in and got all in a huff, I should say the previous administration, all in a huff about the stuff that the previous administration had done, and went through a whole bunch of executive orders in that first month or so, just undoing a whole bunch of stuff that had been done by executive order by Obama. So now Trump does a bunch of executive orders, and the Democrats get all huffy, and now when they get in power, they do a whole bunch of executive orders. And that's how you don't create consensus. That's how you work at that 51%, 49% margin. And those aren't endurable. What you have to have is 70% buy-in. You have to have everybody on board. You have to have everybody understanding why it's the right solution. And then you might get something that will endure the transitions that we see every 2 to 4 years as our administration and our support for that administration get changed in Congress.
And have actual federal legislation instead of
executive orders.
Executive orders.
Yeah, administrative state operating heavily on your behalf. And that can create problems. There's also organizations like the NoLabels.org, which supports the Problem Solvers Caucus. And this is a effort at the level where we really need it. The people in Washington need to be working together. And the Problem Solvers Caucus is an example of an organization or a group that is actually working on bipartisanship.
And this is a group of Republican and Democratic senators working together to get things done.
That's right. They're going to make it happen, and they're going to make it happen in a way that everybody can smile a little bit. And we don't want to have people jumping up and down and screaming in the streets about how wonderful their solution is. We want people dancing, as it were, together as they propose these great solutions. So anyway, it's all about bipartisanship, and I think that's an important component as we move forward. So,
and I would just like to end this bit about Rotary by saying, if you're a Rotarian out in the listening audience, please go to our Climate Action website, which is www.rcatnow.com for more information. And if you're somebody who's interested in being part of a service club that's working on climate action, consider joining the Rotary Club.
Oh, there you go. Ding, ding. So next month on Wednesday, March 3rd at 11 a.m., we're going to be discussing Minnesota winters. Are they really getting warmer, and does it matter?
Warmer winters, gosh, wouldn't that be nice?
No. It used to be that for 3 months at a time, I could pretty much just throw my dog outside and have him come back in and they'd shake the snow off. Now I've got only maybe a month where I can do that, and the rest of the time they're coming in muddy. I want colder winters. All right, don't miss it.
And so the climate willing and the glaciers don't rise. We'll be here next week with another climate show. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the KYMN Climate Show, airing the first Wednesday of every month here on 95.1 FM and AM 1080. Your hosts have been Bruce Moreland and Alan Anderson. Copies of today's show are available for podcast at kymnradio.net.